This is Gareth Southgate, and this is the Three Lions Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Three Lions Podcast. My name is Russell Osborne, and this is an independent England football supporters podcast. I hope you're keeping well. I hope you've enjoyed the recent episodes that have come your way. There have been a couple. There was the one on Glenn Hoddle with Jacob Steinberg. That was another in our England manager series. We also had another in our Your England Journey series, most recently with Matt Edgar. Both of those can still be heard at your podcast provider of choice or threelionspodcast.com. And don't forget, if you'd like to share your England journey, just drop me a line on social media or threelionspodcast@gmail.com and we'll have a chat. Simple as that. I'd love it. Right. Busy episode this one, so let's crack on. This is the Brazil and Belgium preview episode. It is our first two senior men opponents for 2024, both at Wembley. Brazil on Saturday the 23rd of March, kick off at 7 p.m, and then Belgium on the following Tuesday, the 26th of March, at a 7:45 kickoff. Coming up, I'll be chatting with people who know a little more about both of them than I do, although it has to be said, and I've no doubt it's the same for you, but some of those opposition players, oh, they look a little familiar. Plus, Gareth Southgate announced his latest squad on Thursday the 14th. I'll take a look at that in a moment. But first, if you don't mind, can I just touch on the release of the new shirts? If you don't know by now, Nike and England have released a new set of home and away shirts. The images, they've been online for some time now. As you'd expect, it's a white home, looks nice, slightly different collar, interesting shorts, nice little sleeve details. They'll be in a sports shop near you very soon to take a look at up close. The away is a deep purple, or dark raisin, as I think it's officially titled. It's very un-England away, and it's certainly divided opinion. But I have to say, I do like it. But what I don't like is the little details behind it all. We have a new away shirt. It replaces the red away one that was released in September 2022. It was ahead of the Qatar World Cup. Wasn't worn at the World Cup. In fact, it was only worn twice, against Germany in September of 2022. The 3-3 draw, remember that one? The Nations League? And then away to Ukraine, the game in Poland, where we drew 1-1. And the under-21s, they've only worn it twice too. And then there is the Lionesses. Since 2019, they have had their own bespoke kits. Three homes, three aways. And now it appears that they'll be wearing the same shirts as the men, same kits. Which is a shame. I have to say, I quite like the individuality of them. But whilst I can't be sure, but I do wonder if it was the sales of them were maybe not as high as Nike and England had hoped. But that's just me speculating. But it does mean that the Lionesses' last home and away kit that was released last year, 2023, ahead of the World Cup down under, that now becomes redundant. The blue away shirt, quite like that one, it was the one that we lost the final in, that was only worn four times. And the Lionesses have already announced that they'll be wearing the new kit against Sweden in their Euro campaign at Wembley. I think it's safe to say that these new shirts will be, I don't know, just shy of £100 each. I think it's downright disgusting, I have to say, the price of them and also the frequency of them. You remember back in the day when Umbro used to put a use-by date on them? Or the shirts they came out in alternate years. One season it would be the home one, then the next year would be the away one, and they would have a 2-year cycle. Long gone are those days. Still, sorry, just a little rant of mine. I do like the shirts. I just don't like the industry, I think, if truth be told. Right, let's get back to business. Let's take a look at that squad that Gareth has announced. Now, I think this has turned out to be one of Gareth Southgate's most fascinating squads of recent times. There's been a lot of players who were vying for contention. Now, despite the Euro squad in the summer, that's going to be a 23-man squad. This squad, Gareth has selected 25 players this time, just as he initially did back in November of last year. So let's run through it first before we dissect it. Now, I'm recording this bit prior to the weekend's fixtures. We will see who withdraws for whatever reasons, and I'll edit that bit in. But yeah, let's just run through the squad. Three goalkeepers, Sam Johnstone, Jordan Pickford and Aaron Ramsdale. There's eight defenders, Jared Branthwaite of Everton, Ben Chilwell, Lewis Dunk, Joe Gomez, Ezri Konsa from Aston Villa, Harry Maguire, John Stones, Kyle Walker. Five midfielders, Jude Bellingham, Conor Gallagher, Jordan Henderson, James Maddison and Declan Rice. And he has selected nine strikers. Jared Bowen, Phil Foden, Anthony Gordon from Newcastle, Harry Kane, Cole Palmer, Marcus Rashford, Bukayo Saka, Ivan Toney and Ollie Watkins. It is a squad with 711 caps, 117 goals. It has an average age of 26.6. Now, the most capped player within it is Harry Kane with 89 caps. He, of course, has the most goals with 62. He is the all-time England goal-scoring record holder. The youngest player is Jude Bellingham at just 20 years old. The oldest is Kyle Walker at 33, as is Jordan Henderson. I think Kyle Walker is just a month older than Henderson. When you start to consider age, I wonder if those two, maybe Maguire as well, it's highly likely to be their last tournament, the Euros, should they be selected. I wonder if we'll see a few international retirements come the summer. Now, as for the uncapped, we have three. Anthony Gordon of Newcastle, Jared Branthwaite of Everton, and also Ezri Konsa from Aston Villa. Konsa was actually called up for the first time last November for the Malta and North Macedonia games, but he didn't make the pitch. But it is a squad made up of three from Arsenal, Chelsea and Manchester City, two from Everton, Manchester United and Aston Villa, and one from Crystal Palace, Brighton, Liverpool, Brentford, Newcastle, Tottenham, West Ham, and three overseas clubs, Real Madrid, Bayern Munich and Ajax, Bellingham, Kane and Henderson, respectively. Now, Ivan Toney is back after his ban. His only previous appearance for England was at home to Ukraine last March. Joe Gomez is also back in. Now, he last played in 2020 in a 3-0 victory over Wales. Marcus Rashford, of course, been in the news quite a bit of late. Despite scoring few goals for Manchester United, his dip in form has caused a lot of conversation. Gareth obviously knows what Marcus is like on and off the pitch, so I guess it wasn't really a surprise to see his name come up. There's a few injuries that have prevented Jack Grealish, Luke Shaw and Kieran Trippier from being called up. And then there is the absences. Calvin Phillips is probably the first on the list. His form really for West Ham perhaps has let him down. Southgate mentioned that in his press conference. No Raheem Sterling, no Eric Dier, no Jadon Sancho, which doesn't really surprise me, despite the fact he's doing quite well over at Dortmund, back in his happy place. Eric Dier at Bayern Munich doing quite well. There was a bit of goalkeeper talk as well about Jack Butland of Rangers. Obviously, Aaron Ramsdale of Arsenal not getting too much action on the pitch bar one game. And a lot was made of that, of course. But Gareth has stuck with and who he knows he can rely on. But Ross Barkley was also spoken about of Luton. Manchester United's Kobbie Mainoo as well didn't get the call up. Dominic Solanke, maybe a bit of a surprise despite all his goals for Bournemouth. But I guess on the flip side, just shows us the amount of quality that is still available to us. But Gareth's press conference seemed to be dominated by the absence of Ben White. The absence, he hasn't played for England for quite some time now. And the fact that Ben White didn't want to be made available for selection, that's the talking point. It's clearly a big deal at the moment, because White is having a great season for Arsenal and where they are in the Premier League. He's currently got 4 caps and, yeah, he last played against the Ivory Coast in 2022. But it's nothing new, really. Players have refused to play or be selected by their country before. It's nothing new. It's happened now and it will happen again. Southgate was pushed on the subject, and he did say if he was available, he would be selected. And then he, of course, mentioned Steve Holland. Now, they said that there were no issues there. The reasoning of bringing Steve Holland into the conversation is supposedly, back to the Qatar World Cup, Ben White returned home midway through the World Cup after a bust-up with Steve Holland. That's the story. Whether we'll ever get to the bottom of it, I don't know. But Gareth was very supportive of Holland, as you would expect him to be. But that kind of dominated the press conference, really, didn't it? The non-selection of Ben White. But interestingly, Gareth referred to someone in his very first squad, someone who back then refused to call up. Who? He wouldn't elaborate, and we'll probably never know. We can all speculate. He'd have to go back, 8 years or so. But as I say, it's happened before. It'll happen again. Back in 1997, after only one cap, Chris Sutton was selected to play for the England B team by Glenn Hoddle. Sutton took umbrage to this, threw his toys out of the pram and said he'd never play for England again. And ultimately, he didn't. Danny Drinkwater, when at Chelsea, apparently in 2017, Gareth Southgate had an injury crisis. Drinkwater refused to sort of be called up. And likewise, he would never be called up to play for England again. Michael Carrick, he dismissed Roy Hodgson's offer of a place in the England squad for the Euros in 2012. Now, he hadn't played for England for the previous nigh on 3 years. He did later play for England a few more games, but he did sort of turn down the chance to play. There was another one that I found, Fabio Capello. When he was in charge, goalkeeper Ben Foster, he took a break from international football, but by all accounts, he didn't tell Capello of his decision, which is a bit silly, really. Apparently, Capello only found out after reading on Birmingham City's website. Just got visions of Capello tapping away and going to Birmingham City dot co.uk or whatever it is, and seeing that Ben Foster didn't want to play on there. But other nations, they've had players choosing not to play for their country. So it's nothing new there. Michael Ballack had a falling out with the German FA and refused the opportunity to make it to 100 caps. He ended his career on 98. Michael Laudrup and Jan Molby decided that they wouldn't represent Denmark after falling out with the coach of the time then, and they missed the chance of a winner's medal in Euro 92. You remember Roy Keane? He walked away from the Republic of Ireland World Cup team of 2002 after falling out with Mick McCarthy, the manager then. Roy Keane was then seen walking his dog back home instead. And Mexico, Carlos Vela, he had an up-and-down relationship with his national side. So, yes, it's frustrating that Ben White has made himself unavailable for England. Ultimately, it's his decision. We've got the cover for him. Here's what it is. But that is our squad to face Brazil and Belgium. So the bit to edit in. With a weekend passing with only 14 Premier League teams playing, either in the league or the FA Cup, the main point of concern was actually away from England and over in Germany. Harry Kane appears to have hurt his ankle in stretching for a ball. His ankle collided with a post in Bayern's 5-2 victory over Darmstadt, a game where Kane broke the record of most goals in a debut season, 31. This was one more than his record whilst at Spurs too. Now, at the time of recording, nothing has been confirmed as to who has withdrawn. There's been no talk of any England players withdrawing. But the last time Kane actually withdrew from an England squad was way back in November 2017. He had a knee injury then in a game against Crystal Palace. Our opponents back then were Germany and Brazil. And if I'm honest, if he does miss out, I don't think it's a massive issue. We've got 8 other strikers selected. It's not as if Kane is going to suddenly bring something new to the table that we don't know about. So I'd rather him concentrate on being 100% for the summer. Then, on Tuesday the 19th, out of the blue, Manchester United's Kobbie Mainoo was called up to the squad. This was before any withdrawals had been announced. Now, I've no doubt that Mainoo will be part of the England setup in the near future, especially as the Nations League begins later in the year. But I don't understand the reasoning to call him up, especially 5 days after Gareth Southgate said this in his press conference.
You mentioned Kobbie Mainoo there. Is it right that you don't think he's quite ready to make that step up into the senior squad and he's probably going to be with the 21s?
Well, I think that he's doing brilliantly for a young player, and we're never slow to put a young player into the seniors, but he's only had a handful of games, and you have to be very careful development-wise in making those decisions at the right time. So we think ideally we should allow him that that space to develop at his own speed. You know, he's not at the point in terms of number of games or that Jude or Bukayo were when they came in for the first time. But I repeat, he's doing really well for a young player. He's a good footballer. You can see that. He's getting some fabulous experience with Manchester United at the moment and looks a really good character.
But it wasn't just England, though, who had a few issues. For Brazil, Casemiro also withdrew hours before Manchester United's FA Cup match with Liverpool. Perhaps his legs actually have gone. And then the following day, Arsenal's Gabriel has also withdrawn with an unspecified injury. It's a shame that these couple of fixtures, because we'll miss the chance of seeing some of the greatest players. And we'll come to Neymar and De Bruyne soon. Okay then, time to have our first look at our opponents. Let's start with Brazil. This gives me an excuse to play, it's a little guilty pleasure of mine, Brazilian Samba. Okay, it may not be the best weather for it, but I promise you, when the sun comes out, put a bit of this on, a bit of Bossa Nova. Sergio Mendes, Elis Regina. Anyway, I love it. England's first meeting with Brazil was back in 1956 at Wembley, where we won 4-2. And you'd think that would be the start of a big new era. But to date, that is only one of four victories we have had over Brazil. We've actually played 26, we've won 4, drawn 11 and lost 11. And our most recent meeting was a 0-0 draw at Wembley in 2017. Actually, of those 26 matches, 12 have been played here in England. Only 6 have been played in Brazil, and the other 6 have either been at World Cup finals or neutral venues like Los Angeles, Paris, Qatar. And of course, one of the most famous games was played in Rio de Janeiro back in 1984 when we won 2-0.
Good ball there for Barnes. Now can he take Leandro? John Barnes now. Michael all the way for England. Barnes. He scored. And England amazingly are into the lead. First goal for England. What a place to get it. John Barnes, that long, amazing dribble. And Barnes here in Rio has performed a miracle there.
Yeah, you know all about John Barnes' goal. Do you know who scored the other one? Mark Hatley. He was a Portsmouth player at the time. As a squad, the Brazilian squad, there are some familiar names in it, but there is one glaring omission. No Neymar. He suffered an ACL injury in October of last year in a defeat to Uruguay in their World Cup qualifiers. And talking of their qualifying, currently they are 6th in the South American group. After just 6 games, they've won 2, drawn 1 and lost 3. Now, it is worth noting that the top 6 do qualify for the World Cup of 2026. So I can't imagine they're panicking too much just yet. But they did lose their last 3 to Uruguay, Colombia and Argentina. That one never goes down well, does it, losing to Argentina? And the next round of matches for the South American qualifying is not until September of this year. Now, after the Qatar World Cup, Tite, who had taken them to the past 2 World Cups and also a Copa America win in 2019, he stepped down. He was the 77th full-time Brazilian manager. Compare that to England's 15. Tite was replaced by the new manager, Dorival Jr., who came into the role in early January. There were a couple of caretakers in between too. Now, it seemed the Brazilian FA were holding out for Carlo Ancelotti, but he chose to extend his contract with Real Madrid. So I guess the Brazilian FA, their hand was forced. Dorival was previously in charge of Sao Paulo. And you can only imagine the pressure on him to get off to a good start against England and indeed Spain, who they also play in this international window. So let's just take a look through the Brazilian squad. I said it had been announced at the beginning of the month. Obviously, some games, domestic games, have been played since then. And as is the way, players get injured, as we fully well know. There was the Manchester City-Liverpool game recently, the draw between the two teams at the top of the Premier League. City goalkeeper Ederson He was initially selected, but he's since pulled out after getting injured in that game. Likewise, Gabriel Martinelli of Arsenal, he's withdrawn too. But other familiar names include Gabriel of Arsenal, Andres Pereira of Fulham, Bruno, Newcastle, Douglas Luiz of Aston Villa, Lucas Paquetá of West Ham and Casemiro of Manchester United. There was an article recently I saw about Casemiro. I think it was along the lines of his legs have gone. This would be just right for him to prove that article wrong, wouldn't it? There's also Richarlison of Spurs. Now, I thought Spurs had ruled him out, but he still seems to be in. And then there is the European names you might also recognise too. Danilo of Juventus. Wendell of Porto. Did you see? He had a magnificent game against Arsenal in the Champions League recently. It's going to be great to see him come up against Saka. That was quite an even contest, that one. Wendell and Saka. Galeno. Also of Porto, scored the first goal over in Porto between the two. And then, of course, there is Vinicius Junior of Real Madrid. Doesn't matter what sort of era it is, Brazil, well, they will always, always have some spectacular players. It's just whether they can come together as a team, isn't it? We shall see. Now it's my pleasure to
welcome Ricardo Araújo to the Three Lions podcast, a Brazilian living and working here in England. Ricardo, hello there.
How are we doing? I'm good. Thanks very much. Thanks for having me. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Thanks for joining us.
Yes, so you're it's a pleasure.
A Brazilian living in England. How did you manage that? How did you end up here?
Well, actually, I have lived. I wouldn't say around the world, but in some countries. So, of course, Brazil, where I was born and raised. And then first time I went out was to study in Spain. So what I did for a year, like an internship program, got back to Brazil. After graduate and finished master's, went to United States for about 3 years. Got back to Brazil. And then England for the last 12 years now.
Oh, wow. So you're almost a resident.
I am, actually.
Oh, you are? Okay, fair enough. back home, Brazil, where is home in Brazil?
Well, I was born in the last state of the south. It's called Rio Grande do Sul.
Okay.
My state's border with Uruguay and Argentina and is based in the south region of Brazil.
Right. Okay, so I'm just sort of picturing the map of Brazil and obviously Rio and Sao Paulo quite higher up. You're quite a distance from there, were you?
Right.
The Amazon.
On a flight would be from Rio 2 hours down south, and from Sao Paulo 1.5 hours down south.
Ah, I see. So have you got a Brazilian team back home?
I got one. It's called Grêmio. Grêmio. Football Porto Alegrense.
I've heard of Grêmio. Now, are they the team with the like green, red, and white stripes? Is that them?
Is that blue, white, and black? Yes.
Okay. So you still managed to follow them from England, do you?
I followed. Not as much. I followed a bit last year as Suarez. Was playing for Grêmio, so he played last season. So it was good. We had really good results and performance. We are qualified for the equivalent tournament as Champions League is. It's called Libertadores de America.
Oh, yes.
So next year, as we were this year as well, but we didn't get great results, let's say.
Right.
So we are again in. And we with that great name of the world football, Luis Suarez playing there, let's say worthwhile to follow, you see?
Yeah.
I'm not sure how it's going to be this season. So let's see. I hope we have some talents come from what we call the base. So the inferior divisions of the club, you know.
So is the Brazilian, the Brazilian season hasn't started yet, has it? Has it got different time frames?
Not for the National League, no. It's no. always me. But the state championship, yes. And the Brazilian Cup as well.
I see. Well, we talk international football here on the Three Lions podcast. Talking England and Brazil, obviously when Brazil come to town, or I guess wherever Brazil play, it's always a big deal. What's it like following Brazil and the national team?
Well, starting you know, in the past years, and football in Brazil is a cultural manner, let's say, a little bit above and beyond just a sport. So every kid, doesn't matter if it's a boy or a girl, when they start to walk, they always have a ball around to play. It could be inside of the house, it could be down to the playground, it could be on the street. You know, on the favelas, they play on the pitches that they sometimes they make in some terrain and some land. And well, he's pretty strong. He's good and bad, because when Brazil doesn't perform well and has a cycle that we are living now, that not performing well on the last World Cups since 2002 was the last one that we won. It's kind of a little bit frustrated, because we understand that the football evolved everywhere in the world. Arabic world, you know, Morocco on the last World Cup did really well.
Yeah.
Even Japan, the Asian football is growing up, World Cup after World Cup, African football, natural talent. And Brazil, I feel like, got on the last years, let's say good last two decades, a little bit stagnated, no evolution. So after the generation of Ronaldo, Roberto Carlos, Kaká, Ronaldinho, Gaúcho, they couldn't perform well. Not for a lack of talent, I would say. I wouldn't say, because if you see the list of the teams, if you see the Brazilian list, a lot of them play here in Europe. You know, yes. Some in England even, Arsenal, Tottenham. It's just a lack of, I think, management, because football strategically, like the tactics, evolved so much. You know, Brazil still has that happen fast feet that could do juggle with the ball, but the sport evolved.
Mm.
And I believe as a national team, we didn't evolve as such.
That's
so interesting. When we come into the pitch now, that respect that was there before is not anymore. So everybody's conscious that Brazil now is a beatable, is a human team, is a, you know, I wouldn't say average, but it's possible.
Yes.
Like before, when Brazil went, you know, Pelé times, Romario times, 94. Ronaldo times. So just because those guys were on the pitch, we had a psychological advantage that is not there anymore.
Gotcha. Yeah. So the players...
Personal view, of course.
Yeah. Like you mentioned all those players there, Rivaldo, Romario, and all of those, Roberto Carlos, they were iconic of the time. And I guess, yeah, what you're saying, whilst you've got fantastic players at the moment, like Vinicius Jr. and Martinelli, Jesus as well, those aren't in the squad. They're just not of the same aura. I don't know if that same aura, do they?
There's a lot of things involved, of course, because before a football player, he's an athlete, he's a human being.
Mm.
As an emotional and psychological side, I believe. And the great management, the secret of a manager is bring that emotional and psychological side of the human beings together. Put everybody on the same boat, going in the same direction, having the same view. And that's what I don't think on the last two decades, any of our managers have been able to do outstandingly. You see?
Yeah.
You saw that vanity is all, there is no sincerity. So when you see the previous national teams from the old times, of course you had the one that was like the exceptional. But everybody had a bit of skill, everybody had, and no one was afraid to show, and they divide the responsibility, right?
Yeah.
And then we had on this generation, the generation post Ronaldo, post 2002, we had one lack, and then Neymar came, and Neymar was given one position inside of the Brazilian national team that he wasn't ready to.
Mm.
And he, in my personal opinion, he never been. It's not the posture. It's not the head, the mindset of a Brazilian national team number 10.
Yeah.
You see?
Gotcha.
It transcends the pitch. It transcends the inside of training sessions. You have to be a man for that. You see?
Yeah,
and it been born in Brazil and get to the Brazilian national team is another thing. If you're not ready for, you have to be a man and say, "Look, it's not for me," or give the 10 to another guy and just be a player that could do nice things with the ball, but don't take the responsibility because we need a leader inside of the pitch, and we don't have it, really.
So Brazil have got a new manager now. Is it Dorival Jr.?
Dorival Jr., yeah. Dorival Jr., in the beginning of Neymar's career, had a really bad fall with Neymar publicly, you know, like the press, was side of the pitch, and Neymar inside yelling on him.
Oh, right.
To a penalty, and they don't have of course, it was years and years and years ago, was at Santos, when Neymar was playing for Santos still. And there is a declaration of Dorival after the game saying, "We are creating a monster."
Wow.
We are creating a monster. And he wasn't there wrong, I don't think.
So do you think Dorival is the right man for the Brazil job? You say about the manager needs to bring out the respect and personality of these players. Can he do that?
Yeah, with no offense to Dorival, he's beyond a football coach and manager. He's a professor, and you know, this kind of things.
Mm.
But he's not really be able to manage the vanity, ego, and fame. Is really strategically build a competitive team. And when I say competitive, is that team that would fill the people's eyes whatever they play with the kind of football that Brazil is able to do. And for me, there is one name in the world today that would be a potential solution, that's called Guardiola.
Ah.
However, we never had in Brazil, I don't know why, is a vanity, is a by reason. I can't tell really why. We never had a international coach for the Brazilian national team. But that man understands. He makes his teams. He did on Barcelona. He's doing so well through the seasons at Man City. That collective game. A skilled collective game, I would say.
Yeah.
Consistently, you see. That's the kind of football that I personally like to watch.
Yeah. He'll be in high demand, Guardiola, when it comes round to when he gives up Manchester City. I don't think he'll be short of offers, will he?
Definitely. And his price, of course, is...
Of course.
This is ultra. I don't know if the Brazilian National Federation would. I believe they would be able to, because what they have in terms of marketing contracts and Nike with sponsoring is enormous. You see,
yeah, Well, we shall see. It'll be a few years down the line, I think, before that scenario is maybe reached. But let's move on to the game against England. What's the feeling, though, with coming to Wembley? Is it a game that you're going to come to?
I didn't check the ticket yet, but I've been once to Wembley to see, I think it was 2012, Brazil and England, when Ronaldinho was playing still, but leaving the national team. He didn't go to that World Cup.
Right.
And yeah, we lost 2-1, actually.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. It was a game out, was it, actually?
Did that magical goal on the second half.
Yeah.
Like a magical touch, I would say.
It's not often that England beat Brazil, is it?
I'm not aware, but I know it's very, very, how can I say, even.
Well, no, you'd be far, be surprised.
You have that?
No, England have only beaten Brazil on 4 occasions.
Really?
Yeah. So I think, well, Brazil have clearly got the upper hand, but I wonder if this game coming up will be one that England can win. I mean, I'm wondering that because Brazil don't have any sort of competitive games, the World Cup qualifiers until September, and obviously with the European Championships coming up in the summer, that I'm sure obviously both teams will take it seriously, but maybe England will feel they may take it a little bit more seriously. I don't know. How would that go down?
England come very consistently with the same team, with the same coach, which makes a big difference. So the connection and the, how can I say, the fact that the players know each other inside of the field, the way that they run or do their movements and things, it makes much easier. So when you have the team that comes together as England is coming to the game. Brazil, on the other side, is a new coach. Is the first lead that he's released, first list. We have a few more players that are playing in Brazil, is still very young, like Hendrick, for example, from Palmeiras.
Hmm.
And it would be really the first time that these names will be put together.
Okay.
You can have like the base of the main team, like 6 to 8 players that have been playing before, but not all of the 12. What doesn't happen to England? England might have 1 new or 2 new names, if I'm not wrong. But the base of the team is there.
Yeah.
You see?
Yep, yep.
And if England play in Wembley, which is, we call in Brazil Wembley one of the temples of the football in the world, very, very respected by us. And I would say it'll be even intimidating. So when you come and play in London against England in Wembley, is another panorama. You see? So I believe England at this occasion has a little bit of advantage against Brazil. It's pretty possible that England could beat Brazil, you know, maybe 1-0, 2-1, let's say. I don't know. But it has everything, I believe.
What would the feeling be like back home if Brazil were to lose? What was it like when Brazil lose?
In the past, it would be much more painful, let's say. The last horrible feeling which we had was on 2014 when we lost the semifinal 7-1 against Germany.
Oh, I didn't want to bring that one up, but seeing as you have.
We have to learn from those mistakes.
Absolutely.
Of course. It hurts, but the way that the reaction after the second goal, you could see the faces of the players that made millions to play football. Were there like just with their faces, you know, like what's going on?
Yeah.
And even not running and fighting. You see, be like apathetic, you know what I'm saying? Like pathetic inside. That thing was horrible, man. And then after that, the Brazilian people understood that a lot of change and Brazil is beatable. Brazil is not, they're not super football players. They are human beings and they can. Yeah. And it was really good to wake up, really. You see, if Brazil loses, of course, people say, oh, my man, see, we can't stand up. We can't. We're not there yet. We're not there still. If Brazil wins, I would say would be received as a really, really great start for Dorival Jr. Really great start because England is one very, how can I say, strong football team around the world. And we respect a lot. We respect a lot. And, you know, but I believe the general view is the one that I just told you. England is ahead at this occasion, at this time.
So it's an interesting position to be in, because I don't think I've ever been in. I mean, obviously, like you mentioned, the game that we won back in, I think it was it 2012, but I don't ever remember thinking even back then that England were better than Brazil, because there's just that aura. So yeah, it's interesting to maybe be the favourites in this game. But let's just go back a few years to when you last won that World Cup, 2002. Were you back home in Brazil then? What did it feel like to win the World Cup?
That well was the second World Cup. So before I've seen Brazil win in 94.
Of course, yeah.
I was 15 at that time, in 94.
Yeah.
And that was magic, you see. That was like, because all I'd known was just from videotapes and, you know, see on the computer. The previous titles, and Pelé was playing like 3 times world champion, and that thing was outstanding, you see. And then Brazil had a really bad qualifying for 94 World Cup, really, really bad, losing for Bolivia.
Right.
And then we came, I don't know what happened. We came from the back, really did. We almost didn't qualify for 94.
Wow.
Qualify on the last game against Uruguay and Maracanã, 2-0, 2 goals of Romario. And then, yeah, it was magic for that difficulty, for that coming back. And then 2002 was another thing, because we were expecting due to the team that we had and the mentality. So we have big stars, but very low vanity.
Right.
They understood, Ronaldo was coming back from the injury from his knee, you see. And he was doubt until the 6 months before, he was a doubt that he could play. And I believe it was a big redemption for 98, really. And that thing was like, let's say when the American basketball team went to the Olympic Games with the Dream Team twice and won.
Right. Okay. Good comparison. Yeah.
So was like the comparison I would do with that team. With Ronaldo, Rivaldo, Ronaldinho, Roberto Carlos, Cafu, Marcos on the go, you know, and that team was just, and they were play for Ronaldo and they were play for Rivaldo. It's very important. They understood tactically who would make the difference, you see?
Yeah.
And it doesn't happen right now and hasn't been happening for a long time. So hopefully in the near future, we can change that.
Yeah.
But was 2002 was, how can I say, we got the expectative through. We had the feeling and the dream came true, you see?
Yeah.
Which 94, we were not dreaming at all, and it happened. It was a huge surprise. Yeah.
But of course, I mean, 2002 was a game where England and Brazil met, and famously, Ronaldinho, did he mean that from a Brazilian point of view? Do you think he meant to score from that distance, or was it a cross fluke that David Seaman just missed.
Yeah, I'll tell you a thing now, believe it or not, a lot of people, so I don't have a way to prove right now. I studied with Ronaldinho in the same school. We are from the same city in Porto Alegre.
Okay.
And he's three years younger than me.
Yeah.
And outstanding player since he was, 10, 13 years old. He never assumed that he didn't want to score that goal that fall. Yeah.
Mm.
Seeing the way that he kicked the ball, he's not a left foot. Yeah. He's right foot kicker. Right. I am pretty sure. For me to say that, how can I go against the man? I'm not going against. But the way that he kicked that ball, he put a lot of effect, he put a lot of spin, everything. He is really good in what he does. But on the ball make a curve, so that would be a cross, I believe. I don't know if some wind came on, some cross wind, whatever. Was letting go. Was it?
Yeah.
It was not.
Well, we can't have a chat without mentioning Pelé, who sadly is no longer with us. I've been to Naples in Italy and seen sort of the effect that Maradona has around the city there. And I can only assume the aura that Pelé has around Brazil as a country. What was he like as a Brazilian?
Pelé?
Yeah.
He transcended the football player. Pelé, we had two men that had a projection of, an icon on the Brazilian society. An icon as a Brazilian citizen. First one, and most respectful in Brazil, and I believe around the world, is Pelé, for sure.
Yeah.
And the second one was Ayrton Senna.
Okay, of course, yes.
Yes. So those two men, as a sportsman, we've never had the projection. We've never had the reference, because Pelé, whatever he stepped, was Brazil on that man. You did not have to say anything. He did not have to have any flag or anything. When you see that figure, you were immediately remembering and the name Brazil came up.
Yeah.
Ayrton Senna, at the end, on the last year of his career as well, he always had the habit after a win, after a victory, put the Brazilian flag on the car and do one lap, saluting the crowd.
Hmm.
At Williams on that fatidic season, he didn't have a chance of, but was a big loss, for us. So I think those two were an icon and as a Brazilian person, you see.
Yeah.
Those two, no more. And I don't think we would have anybody with that dimension too soon for us.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. It's nice to hear from your perspective. It's been really enjoyable to have a chat, Ricardo. Do you wanna put a prediction on the game? Yeah, well, I think you've already said, haven't you? You think that England could win?
Well, it's pretty difficult, isn't it? But well, of course, I'm always optimistic about my team. I would say would be a draw 1-1.
Okay. Well, we shall see. I've got your number. I'll sort of text you back if a consolation message or a congratulatory message.
I'll be waiting for. Thank you very much.
No, thank you very much for your time. It's been really, really appreciated. And just for giving us a little insight into Brazilian football and culture.
That's good. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me. And hope to talk to you soon in the future. Maybe in one eventual Brazilian and England game in some World Cup, That would be great.
That would be good. We'll be right back. Now, I know I played a bit of samba for Brazil, and I have to be honest, my knowledge of Belgian music isn't really up to scratch. So I had to do a little bit of research to ensure that this was evened up. Imagine my surprise when I found out that the Eurodance artist Technotronic, who had the 1989 hit Pump Up the Jam, came from Belgium. Oh, I don't need any encouragement here.
The jam, pump it up while your feet are stumping, and the jam is pumping. Look ahead, the crowd is jumping.
Our history against Belgium, right? It feels like it's had some fairly recent action, but we've not actually met since 2020. It was twice then in the Nations League, and then just before that in the 2018 World Cup. It's amazing how time flies. But in total, we've met on 25 occasions, winning 16, drawing 5, and only losing 4. And in fact, that last meeting was one of those games in the Nations League where we went down 2-0 behind closed doors in Leuven. And of those 25 games, 17 have been friendlies. In fact, our first 13 were friendlies. I guess back then, with it just being a short hop over the channel, I guess it was easily arranged. But let's cut to the chase. Let's have a chat. It's my pleasure to welcome to the podcast Scott Coyne from the Belgian Football Podcast. Hello, Scott.
Hello, Russell. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Yourself?
I'm good, thanks. What a delight to be here. Great chance to talk about what I think will be quite an exciting game coming up.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. Two evenly matched teams, I think. Just firstly, let's just cover the initial, the Belgian Football Podcast. Just tell us a little bit about that and yourself.
Yeah, well, the Belgian Football Podcast, or the BFP, has been running for a little bit over 3 years now. We produce a weekly show that covers all the action and news across the top flight in Belgium, the Pro League. And we also try to cover as much as possible about the division below, which is known as the Challenger Pro League. And when fixtures like this one come up as well, we also like to try and produce little extra special episodes covering the national team as well, because we do our best to cover the Red Devils. And throughout the season, we like to invite some guests along from inside clubs to do deep dives into some specific aspects around Belgian football culture. So we're a three-man team. We've all got slightly different interests. Hopefully we complement each other kind of quite well. We've exploded really over the last 3 years. There's a lot of interest in Belgian football for reasons that we probably don't have time to cover fully here today, but it's a wonderful league to develop young talent. Yeah. And that's one of the main reasons why, there is so much, attention on it as a league, now, but we're having great fun doing that and, plenty more to come from us.
Superb. Well, Belgian football, initially the accent from yourself, doesn't sound Belgian. How did yourself get involved in this?
Well, as I was saying, Russell, there's three of us at the BFP. So I am, in fact, Scottish. I'm based just outside Glasgow. I have some Belgian ancestry on my partner's side. So I've been lucky enough to spend a reasonable amount of time in Belgium and do a good amount of travelling there, and kind of discovered a long time ago that I really love the country. I really like the beer as well, but that's probably for another podcast. You know, everybody knows about how good Belgian beer is. I've always been a big football fan. So I think my love of football and Belgium is probably going to come together somehow at some point. And luckily I happened to find the regular BFP host Ben Jackson, who founded the podcast by accident very early on, much like our Joris, who is actually Belgian. Joris is from just outside Antwerp. Yeah, so the three of us kind of come together and are doing our best to cover Belgian football in depth regularly on a weekly basis for an English speaking audience, and we've had a great reception and it seems to be doing quite well.
Excellent. Well, we'll find out where you can catch up with you guys towards the end. We'll give you all the links. But let's crack on to the game, which takes place. I think it's the Tuesday, the 27th at Wembley. You play the Republic of Ireland in Dublin a few days before that. But when Belgium initially got announced, but the first thing that came to my mind was Roberto Martinez. Oh, it'd be good to see him again. And then I realized, actually, it's been probably that long. He's not there in charge anymore. You're actually managed by an Italian, aren't you?
Yes, just over a year ago now, last February, Domenico Tedesco took over from Roberto Martinez. And Domenico is a name that perhaps lovers and followers of German football might know a little bit more about. He was actually, he was a name that kind of, he was appointed kind of quite quickly, not so much out of the blue, but it wasn't a name that many people expected to be seriously in contention for the post. And there is actually a little story here, a little bit of background. At the same time, Club Bruges were actually looking for a new manager. And the Belgian FA put a panel, a kind of specialist panel together, really, that was made up of a number of kind of quite high profile figures from top clubs in Belgium. And they were tasked with advising the FA on possible suitable candidates. And one of the candidates who came up in this shortlist was actually Domenico. And Domenico was actually interviewed for, at that time, the then vacant Club Bruges manager's job as well. They were looking for a new coach. And I think he actually impressed at that particular interview. And that's what led to him being invited, I think, to be interviewed for the Belgian job. Did a wonderful presentation, actually. Obviously did a lot of research, impressed greatly and was offered the role. He's been in post now for just over a year. And in fact, yesterday, the squad for this particular game was announced, along with a contract extension for Domenico. The side have been undefeated since he came in. They've pretty much cruised the qualifying campaign. Yeah. They won 6, drew 2, didn't lose any, were top scorers with 22 and only conceded 4. So they've done very well. I think there were a lot of question marks around him when he came in, not so much about him personally, but because I think there was an awareness that the squad needed to be refreshed. There was a general feeling that a cycle had by and large come to an end. And there's a huge wealth of real talent there, ready to come through now. So it's a big job, really, kind of managing that and managing it in a way that's kind of cohesive and doesn't disrupt the entire setup. But I think he's done very well to kind of blend some of that new talent coming through, which was very much necessary, with some real decent experience in there as well. So he's been really good. And the only downside, I think, since he's come in has perhaps been his falling out with Thibaut Courtois. There's been a big falling out there over the captaincy, which has led to Courtois leaving the squad. And Domenico actually yesterday at the press conference confirmed that it's highly unlikely that Courtois will come back into the national setup as long as Domenico's around. And with that contract extension, that's up to the next World Cup in 26. So that's been the only real downside, because that's not ideal. He's a really high profile player, probably one of the best goalkeepers in the world. So a personal falling out there has been the only kind of black mark there. But he's been very good, and the fans are feeling good about the national team again, which is important, because for a while there'd been a bit of a disconnect. I think there was a feeling that, like I say, that a cycle had come to an end and that things needed refreshed, and that's what's happened.
Well, yeah, you mentioned the cycle, because I mean I think at a time there was sort of, I don't know, maybe people on the outside, England fans, I guess, maybe just looking at Belgium and having played them on a few occasions recently. You see, like, Lukaku, Courtois, De Bruyne, and yes, we see them quite often, but because they've been there constantly, you kind of think, oh, they're always there. They must have an aging squad. It's like they're coming to the end of their cycle. But as you say, the national squad have got these players coming through that are sort of taking over, or progressing the team forward. I mean, you just have to look at Doku at Manchester City. There's certainly players coming through there, and I think it's probably an unfair comment to say that Belgium aren't the side that they once were. I think they're consistently going forward.
Yeah, I mean, I was making the point that there's a huge amount of talent there. Mm. And I often say when I'm talking about the Red Devils, and I'm going to say it again here because I think it's so important, and there's a huge amount of talent even in the under-21s. The big argument that a lot of fans of the national team in Belgium have is that they would like to see some of those players who often are in the under-21 squad in the senior setup.
Yeah.
And I can kind of understand that, but obviously you're limited to places, and I think the options at Dominique Tedesco's disposal are ones that any coach would want. There isn't a shortage of talent. There aren't really any particular positions, I think, in the squad where there are any real issues either. It's just about the choices that you make. I mean, you made the point about, you know, England fans knowing a lot of these players. That's obviously because a lot of the players, particularly in the senior squad, play their club football in England. And when you look at the squad that was announced yesterday for this particular fixture and the game against Ireland, there are eight players in that squad who play their club football in England. You know, Castagna, Fass, Tielemans, Anana, Trossard, Doku, Kaminski, and Sells as well. So there's a lot of names there that England fans will know, probably more names they'll know than not know, which is kind of odd, I suppose. You know, when you're playing another national team, a lot of these players play their top level football in England and have done for a long time. And there are a couple of really important players, obviously, who are part of that Roberto Martinez generation who are still there. There are a number of very high profile ones, obviously, who have retired, but the big ones who are still there, and it's because they've still got something to offer, I think, and obviously Kevin De Bruyne, who England fans will be glad to hear is not in this squad because he is carrying a slight injury and has been deliberately left out.
Yeah.
And Romelu Lukaku, who you mentioned, Russell. I mean, Romelu Lukaku's got 14 goals over the 8 qualifying games alone, which is just unbelievable. And his international career is just something you don't see in modern day football anymore. He's got 83 goals and 113 caps. He's so important. And although Mishi Bashwai, who often is his understudy when he's injured or unable to play, has a pretty decent record himself, it's nowhere near that record. But to be fair to Mishi, there aren't many players who would be able to match that record. He's very important to the system and the way that they play, and is a very difficult player to handle. And although he's probably arguably coming down the other side of the peak of his career, he is still performing at this level, which is why he is one of that so-called golden generation, a term I've never liked, who is still there.
Join the club.
Still have a massive amount to contribute. Yeah, it's such an overused phrase with so many sides.
Yeah. So we know plenty of the, was it 8 players, I think you mentioned, that that play in the Premier League or in the English League. Is there any players there that maybe we're not so familiar with that you can see making an impact? Because this second game, for both of us, I don't know if you're going to take the Republic of Ireland game maybe more seriously, as we may take the Brazil game more seriously, and then maybe chop and change a few faces for this particular game. But is there any players that you think, oh, they could be a surprise and we're not aware of yet?
Well, a player I've really enjoyed watching in qualifying, who England fans might not know that much about, is Dodi Lukebakio, a 26-year-old winger who's at Sevilla at the moment. He 2 goals and 3 assists across 5 games in qualifying. He's a player who is quite exciting to watch, but he obviously enjoys being part of the international setup. He produces a really high level there. He's a player that Domenico Tedesco really brought in, I think. Wasn't part of the setup before under Martinez, really. And he just seems to have kind of looked like he's always been there. The big thing with Luca Bacchio is he's a big chance creator and is a big part of that front three now. So, you know, he's a big link between Lukaku and depending on who's on the other side, of course, whether it's Doku or somebody else who has a similar role to fulfill. He's definitely one to watch, I think. You know, he enjoys playing at this level. A player who did make this squad, actually, who surprise is perhaps not the right word, because there have been rumblings for a while, but he's a slight outlier, and that's young Coney de Winter, who's only 21. It's his first call-up for the senior side. He has been part of the under-21 setup. His form at Genoa has been very good for a while now. Domenico Tedesco's been out to see him in person two or three times. And I think there was certainly a call on the fans' part for him to be included, because these particular fixtures, the Ireland one and this one against England, are really the last opportunities for Domenico to maybe have a last look at somebody who might stand a chance of, depending on circumstances, making the Euro squad. And I think Coney de Winter is, you know, maybe the last example of a player who might squeak in there. He's been very, very good in Italy. The Belgian defence has probably been the one area of the side that has needed the most work. That everyone's known this for quite a while. The transition that Domenico's made in bringing in players like Arthur Thiat, whose progress has been great, particularly since he left Belgium. He's been having a good time in Italy. His profile is raising all the time. Wout Faas as well, who's at Leicester, who is a player I quite like. I mean, there's a number of people who have criticisms of him for various levels, but I think he's done kind of quite well. And I think still having you know, Jan Vertonghen around, and that experience is kind of quite important when you're bringing through essentially a new defence. But Tedesco's got options there, and, you know, no shortage of them, and that's exciting. It's just which ones he chooses to take. I mean, you talked about the two sides being quite closely matched. Belgium are now ranked number four in the world. They were number one for a long time. Yeah. They're now number four. England are number three, and there's only 2 points of a difference between the two sides in the rankings as well. And I think the reason this fixture was actually chosen, and this is quite important, so I was saying Belgium cruised their qualifying campaign. And the one great unknown in this new side under this new coach is they've really been untested. That's what I would say. We don't know how they're going to respond at a tournament. The group stage for qualifying, they had Austria, Sweden, Azerbaijan and Estonia. Austria put up a really good fight in campaigning and did quite well. Sweden are not the side that they used to be. They're going through a transition of their own and were kind of nowhere in qualifying. So they've cruised that and were expected to be fair. And they've got a group at the Euros that has Romania, Slovakia, and one other side we don't know who's going to be yet. That's right. Who's going to win playoff B's path. That's a great group. You know, it couldn't have been much better for them, I think. So this fixture's been chosen with a real test in mind, I think, against another top side. And I think that's important that happens at least once before the tournament, because although there are two other games after this fixture, just before the tournament in Brussels against Montenegro and Luxembourg, okay, they're the sorts of games just before the tournament where you hope to get people out en masse and score a lot of goals. It's shooting in a barrel for confidence and to get everybody feeling good about themselves. So this game, I think from a tactical point of view and from a fine tweaking of details pre-tournament is actually really important for Belgium, this one, and will be one worth watching. And I mentioned Tedesco falling out with Courtois. He's been rotating between Mats Cels at Nottingham Forest and Wolfsburg's Koen Castiels. They've both played three games each since this change has been forced upon them. And that's something to look out for. Who'll feature at Wembley, and also who will be the number one choice, of course, at the tournament as well. That's a slight unknown at the moment.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned the Euros coming up, that it's, one of the playoff places will be either Iceland, Bosnia, Israel, Ukraine, alongside Slovakia, Romania. What's the impression you get of Belgian fans about the tournament, about how far they can go? Because obviously you look back, and there was a period of time we had a bit of a purple patch, where the quarters in 2016, third place in 2018 where we met, quarterfinals in 2020. I mean, probably don't like to talk too much about the Qatar World Cup, but what's the general feeling about the Euros coming up in Germany?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I think, you know, I was saying earlier that I think Belgium fans are feeling much more positive about the side again. I think there was a slight malaise towards the end of Roberto Martinez's time. I think fans were a bit frustrated with his rigidness, really, in his selection. Roberto had a system that worked very well for him. And I think people... Yeah, allowed the weight of expectation on that squad. This was a squad that was meant to have won something because of the world-class talent there, of which there was plenty, and they weren't able to do that. And I think there came a point where people became frustrated and went, okay, right, we know there's a lot of talent there in the wings, that transition needs to happen now. And it didn't happen under Roberto for reasons that I can understand. You know, he departed, I think, at the right point. Very poor World Cup, as we know, much poorer than I think even people were expecting. I think coming into that World Cup, there wasn't a great deal of expectation on Belgium anyway. I think there was a feeling that Belgium would have got out of the group, which obviously they failed to do. And I think that has accelerated a little bit what needed to happen. And that's that transition now. The question about how they might do at the tournament is a really interesting one, because that's what I was saying about them not really being tested. We don't know. And tournament football is very different to qualification campaigns. It's a very different psychology. You see a lot of sides tend to cruise their qualifying campaigns, unsurprisingly, but don't necessarily perform as well as arguably they should or could at tournaments. And that's just because tournament football is a very different thing. You have... You know, you have a group of players who are expected to all come together and play at their peak over a 4 to 5 week period. And that's a very difficult thing to coach and train for. And as we've seen in the past, historically, there's actually only a very small number of countries who have really perfected this. My feeling about it is the group draw has been very good for them and very kind to them. And they've played this down, understandably. They will be expected to win that group, I think. And after that, it's really just a combination of circumstances, maybe a little bit of luck. I think realistically, they should really be aiming for a minimum, my view, of the quarterfinals. Yeah. And depending on how the tournament kind of progresses for them and whether they build up any momentum, they could go further. I think Gareth Southgate will see this game as an important one from an England perspective as well. He'll be well aware of the quality in this squad, and I don't think he will underestimate that. He's a very good coach in his own right, and I think he will make it clear to that England squad that this is not a game that they can afford to take lightly, and it's actually a very good test for them as well at exactly Absolutely. The same point. So I think this fixture suits both sides and both coaches for similar reasons, actually.
Yeah. Well, we're just looking at how the competition could pan out, we could meet once again. But it's quite convoluted the amount of teams only going out in the first round and third places coming up. So we shall see whether we meet again. But going back to the game at Wembley, just a short hop down for you. Is it a game that you're going to attend?
One of us may well be there. We try to get as many games as possible. I know for our Ben, who is based not too far from London, Ben, there's a good chance that Ben might certainly be there.
Yeah.
Because he's the closest of us. We will try to get to some games in Brussels, actually, some of the home games.
Yeah.
We've got some reasonable contacts inside the Belgian FA who often can sort us out, which is nice. Kind of good as well. So we'd very much like to have one of us there, yeah.
Oh, great stuff. Well, do you want to give us a prediction?
I think we might see a one each draw, actually.
Yeah.
Quite a close game, you know, pretty competitive. I'll say one each.
Yeah, I think that is the main thing we're going to see, is quite a competitive game between two teams that, as I said at the beginning, are fairly evenly matched. And whilst it's good from an England point of view that De Bruyne won't be available, it's a shame that we don't get to see him in the flesh, because we all know what a fantastic player he is. Just one more thing before we go, the Belgian away shirt. Lovely shirt. I mean, I like my football shirts. Do we know if that's going to be worn?
I don't know if it'll be worn for this particular fixture. It could be, you know, being an away game. I mean, there's an interesting story behind that new away kit, actually. It's sky blue top, light brown shorts and white socks. It's actually a nod to Tintin, comic book character Tintin, who is, of course, Belgian. And the squad announcement yesterday and the announcement of Tedesco's contract extension, interestingly, was made at the Hergé Museum just outside Brussels.
Oh, was it?
Which is kind of a nice way of bringing this together, because all of this was announced and the new kits were officially unveiled. So of course Tintin wears that light blue top and brown shorts. So it's a complete link between those two for those who don't know, and actually quite a nice story. It looks much better in person than it does in pictures. Actually, because the color combination of the light blue and the brown shorts is actually quite odd. But yeah, when you go and see those pictures of Tintin fans will probably snap this kit up.
Yeah, no, it's a cracker of a kit. I really like it. And is it Snowy the dog? I can't.
That's right. Yeah.
Really wondering who will make an entrance as a mascot. Maybe
it'd be a nice idea, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I can't imagine the Wembley ground staff would be too keen, though. Do you want to just give us a plug as to where we can find the Belgian podcast?
Yeah, sure. If you're interested in checking out us, and if English is your main language and you want to find out more about Belgian football, and why wouldn't you, then yeah, the Belgian Football Podcast is probably the best place for you to come. So if you just search under wherever you get your podcast from for the Belgian Football Podcast, you will find us there and be able to add us to your download list.
Marvellous. And I see you're on Twitter at Belgian Podcast as well. I don't know if you're on any other social medias.
Yeah, you can find the BFP at Belgian Podcast on Twitter. You can also find us on Instagram as well. And if you want to hunt me down personally for any reason, because I often do some Belgian football consultancy for agents and other people as well, then you can find me at Coin Consultant.
Marvellous. Scott, thank you very much for your time. It's been much appreciated. Enjoy the game.
You too. It's been a delight to talk to you, Russell. Thanks for having me.
There we go. Thanks to Scott there for his time. As he mentioned, they are on Twitter and Instagram. Just go search Belgian Football Podcast. Go give them a follow. Go give them a like as well. Likewise, thank you very much to Ricardo too for his Brazilian perspective. Really enjoyed putting together this episode. Hope you've enjoyed it too. If you're going to either game or both of them, enjoy them. Safe journeys there and back, and I will be back with you shortly after them, taking a look back over the both games. Now, also, the Lionesses are in action on the 5th of April as they start their Euro 2025 qualifying campaign. Now, I'm not sure when Serena will announce that squad, so I may try and speak with Rich Laverty and look at those upcoming games before the men's review episode. To be honest, I'm not really sure how it's going to fall at the moment. So basically, stay subscribed and you'll find out. Now, just before I round off, I'd just like to acknowledge the passing of former England player, goalkeeper Ron Bainham, who passed away on Monday the 18th, aged 94. Ron won 3 caps for England under Walter Winterbottom, all in 1955, and he was never on the losing side. 5-1 away victory over Denmark, then a 3-0 win over Northern Ireland and a 4-1 win over Spain, both of those at Wembley. Now in 1959, he was selected for a tour of South America, but he didn't make the pitch, so wasn't able to add to those 3 caps that he'd previously won. He was born in 1929 in Birmingham, but he spent the vast majority of his playing career at Luton Town, where he played in an FA Cup final. And at the time of his passing, he was considered the oldest surviving England player. I'd like to pass on my condolences to his family
and friends. So until the next time, take care of yourselves. Cheers.